Okay, hello. This is Paul Bowman again, and I am lucky enough to be talking to Professor Lauren Griffith, who is in a much sunnier part of the world than I am in.
And windier, so if
is
there's
it
background
windier
noise,
too?
I
And
apologize.
we're both on lockdown in our respective countries. I'm in Britain, and Lauren is in Texas, which could be a country in its own right, I guess. And we're having conversations to keep ourselves sane. and I just wanted to talk to Lauren about her work on capoeira. So Lauren is an anthropologist, and she's written a couple of really interesting books on the Afro-Brazilian martial art of capoeira. This is one of them, one of the two books, In Search of Legitimacy: How Outsiders Become Part of the Afro-Brazilian Capoeira Tradition. So, hello, Lauren, how are you
Good.
doing?
I'm hanging in there.
Good. Could these two books, they were published in quite quick succession, weren't they? Were they part of the same research project?
They were part of the same research project in a way. So the original book came out of my doctoral research, and when I graduated, talk about going from one crisis to another, I graduated right in the middle of the Great Recession. So the job market was tough, and I just kind of sat on my dissertation for a couple of years. So just the way things worked out, those two books came out in close succession. But the second one, so in the first one, I put forth this idea of apprenticeship pilgrimage, which is basically the idea that in certain genres, you're going to be compelled to travel and visit the source of an art in order to become legitimate. So when I was shopping that book around, I got some great feedback from a publisher who said, "You know, this is interesting, but we're not really publishing this kind of work right now. What we would love to see is a more theoretical book that looks at different aspects of the apprenticeship pilgrimage idea." And I thought, well, that's interesting, but not what I'm doing right now. So I went ahead, published the first book, which is more of a case study. And then working with a colleague of mine who's also an anthropologist, we took the idea of apprenticeship pilgrimage and then expanded it and looked at different manifestations of it. So yes, they're part of the same project, but it wasn't, I never intended to publish two books on the same-ish topic.
Okay, and are you a capoeirista? You are a capoeirista, aren't you? And a dance scholar as well, or
Yeah, so
are you a dance scholar, or are you a dancer who became an anthropologist who became a capoeirista? What's the sequence?
I knew nothing about martial arts when I was in college. I had never done any martial arts whatsoever. My background was in dance. I grew up dancing mostly modern, a little bit of ballet. In Texas, we have this funny tradition of dance teams, which, you know, is all Friday Night Lights, high school football, that kind of thing. So that's my background. And then I got to college and I was lucky enough to study with Tom Green. And I walked into Tom's office. So if you're a martial arts scholar, you know Tom Green. He's also an anthropologist. I walked into his office and said, "I want to do a research project." And he basically blew me off for weeks, if not months. And when I wouldn't give up, he said, "Okay, I've got this project." And I think he was trying to scare me away. And he said, "There's this thing called capoeira, and you're young enough to go study it." And I said, "Okay." So that was my introduction from a dancer who got roped into doing capoeira. And now I have broader interests that, you know, touch on other areas of martial arts. But yeah, that's sort of my path.
Okay,
So I blame Tom for everything.
so you didn't you had no direct experience of it until you went off to do, and would you was your research a kind of deliberately embodied research kind of a thing? So it was like what Louis Guacon would call a kind of carnal ethnography, or was it like observant practice or something like that?
Participant observation. Yeah, it's participant observation, but definitely heavy on the participation. And in my mind, now, granted, when I first started this, I was probably 20, and I was doing this for my senior thesis, which then turned into a dissertation project, which now has turned into, you know, multiple professional projects. But I didn't realize there was another way to study. a topic. I just thought that you had to, whatever it was, you had to throw yourself into it 100%. So especially with the dance background, it made sense to just go and start taking classes. And that was how I started.
Okay. And so now, I mean, we were lucky enough to have you as a keynote in our conference last May in California. So now you're surrounded as well by people who would define themselves as martial arts studies scholars in different ways. Does your reading, your research, and your interest and awareness go into other martial arts, or are you an anthropologist who like really loves capoeira, or you know, how far and wide do you read in around martial arts studies?
That's a really good question. I think that I am becoming more and more interested in martial arts studies, and I'm going to blame you for that one, because your book, kind of questioning what is martial arts studies, was really interesting to me. And I teach a class called Anthropology of Martial Arts. And that's actually how we start day one, is with the intro chapter of your book. And I have students kind of question, is this a field? Could it be a field? What will this field look like? And that's how we bookend the course, is starting with that and ending with that. There's a lot of great material within anthropology on the martial arts, but there's not wide enough, in my opinion, to build an entire course around it at this point. So in the course of developing that class, I found myself reading scholars who are outside of anthropology, and that's been really exciting to do. So I think that I'm moving in that direction. But I think first and foremost, I'll always consider myself an anthropologist, especially as other things kind of pique my curiosity and I start going off on tangents, doing research with these folks at an ashram in Florida, or doing research with farmers in Belize, which have nothing to do with martial arts.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. I just think that, I mean, because I think that, correct me if I'm wrong, but when I use the word martial arts, I know that in my head, and I always assume in lots of other people's heads, you have a kind of East Asian set of connotations there that are largely right. produced by kind of 1970s, 1980s media culture. Mm-hmm. And most of the martial arts that I had written about or read about had been, you know, East Asian martial arts. But then people like Greg Downey and yourself come to the table talking about capoeira and bringing in concepts like tourism and cultural tourism and pilgrimage. And it's just like, oh my God, it's a really refreshing way of thinking about, I think, what people have long done in all kind of martial arts, where a location becomes a kind of mecca or a kind of fetish, like a kind of, people go on pilgrimages. I mean, do you think that the concepts you've used around capoeira are widely applicable in the study of other martial arts?
Oh, absolutely. And that was one of the things that I really wanted to show in the second book, was just how widely applicable the idea of apprenticeship pilgrimage was. And I was really fortunate when I was still a graduate student at Indiana University, I had a student of my own who designed his own major, and he combined anthropology with theater, took some courses in business, and I can't remember what all went into it. But this student wound up going on an organized trip to China. And I was just chatting with him, and he listed all these different places that he was going to go. And one of the places that he really wanted to go, of course, was Shaolin Temple. So the researcher brain started spinning. I was like, ooh, I wonder if I could talk to the person that organized the trip and all the people that went on this trip. And I was really lucky to be able to do pre and post interviews with these folks to find out, you know, what was it about China that was so important for you to go and visit, and what did you do, and what happened when you were at the Shaolin Temple? Which is a really funny story in and of itself, which I don't know if you want me to share at some point, but the short answer is definitely, I think it's widely applicable.
Yeah, I think, I'm sorry, I was, while you were talking, I was trying to share the cover of your other book, but it keeps just, this one just keeps sharing, so I'm just going to stop. I'm going to give up on that. Sorry, it must be very distracting for you, sorry. Yeah, it's interesting the way that a place becomes becomes such a kind of organizing fantasy, like an orientation, like you have to go to China, you have to go to Japan, or you have to go to Brazil. I mean, Brazil seems like a unique kind of location, because two of the fastest growing and most popular new, I'm going to use bunny quotes, with long traditions, but you know, they're new on the international scene, the new globalizing martial arts are capoeira and so-called Brazilian jiu-jitsu. What do you think's going on with that? Like, they're both from Brazil. I mean, what kind of cultural dynamics do you think produce that?
So it's really interesting to compare the two, and I don't have the citation off the top of my head, but I know that there was a piece, it may have been in a marketing journal. I'm not sure, I could dig up the reference, but it compared the networks that are kept by the instructors of capoeira versus BJJ when they go abroad. And with capoeira, there's much more of a connection with Brazil. So they make trips back, they stay in closer contact with people, versus the BJJ instructors who, when they go abroad and set up a new school, they're there, they're in the new country, and the ties are weaker there. I think some of that has to do with socioeconomic class, but I also think that some of it has to do, at least with capoeira Angola, because that's what I know best. So I don't want to speak out of turn. I think some of this might show up in Regional and might show up in Contemporânea, but definitely in Angola. There's this idea that we owe it to the ancestors to maintain that connection because they sacrificed so much. And when I say ancestors, I'm talking about the enslaved Africans that kept capoeira alive during the colonial period. And then, of course, Brazilians who, you know, continued practicing in secret and kept it going even when it was persecuted and looked down upon. So I think there's this idea that because it was marginalized, because it was, the people were oppressed for so long, it's our duty to maintain that connection with Brazil. So that may be one of the difference. I don't really know. It's really interesting. And since you've been doing BJJ, it would be interesting to see if people are having that same desire to go to, say, Rio to train.
Yeah, I think I agree with the likelihood that people who are Brazilian jiu-jitsu experts, they can migrate and they can have a life outside of Brazil. I'm just speculating now, but yeah. I wonder also if there's a very clear connection with sport and with a belt system and also with the idea of it being like. Brazilian jiu-jitsu, in my experience, is a very free-flowing, like every school, every club is a laboratory. Yeah. And it's, so innovation is really, I'm guessing that a huge amount of the innovation in Brazilian jiu-jitsu happens outside of Brazil now. I mean, whereas, does that happen in capoeira, or does it have, I think there's a different relationship to lineage and to history and to culture. Whereas I think in Brazilian jiu-jitsu, you come up with a new hold or something, or choke or whatever, and you name it after yourself and hooray, well done you. Whereas maybe that's frowned upon in capoeira?
I would say it's frowned upon. So one of the questions that I was asking mestres, these masters, when I was in Brazil is, you know, what is the limit of form? Because you've got to walk this fine line between creativity, innovation. You want to show that you have your own style. But if you go too far, then you're breaking with tradition and that's frowned upon. So how do you find that sweet spot? And a lot of people will tell me that, you know, if you come up with an innovation and it doesn't work, it's going to die on the vine. And that probably applies across the board, right? If you come up with a new move and you get dropped on your back, well, then that was stupid and you're not going to do it again and it's not going to catch on. But I think the stakes are a little bit higher in capoeira for innovation if you are someone that doesn't have a lot of legitimacy. So if you're not a Brazilian, I think anything you invent is going to be kind of treated with a little bit of suspicion.
Okay. Okay, so I guess experts or expertise in capoeira, you're a bit like maybe you're like an auteur. You put your signature on it, and people might identify you in terms of the way that you move, or you're the student of this person. But that could only be valid within certain tacit and very difficult to articulate parameters. Just a sense of propriety, maybe like, no, that's breakdancing. That's tricking. That's taekwondo.
Yeah. I think you articulated that much better than I did in either of the books, but yeah, I think that's exactly what it is, that you can identify someone's style and you can say, oh, well, that's a student of Mestre João Grande. Or that's definitely a Fika player right there because of the way they move. But at the same time, you don't want to be a carbon copy of somebody else. And it's kind of become a running joke. Mestre João Grande is a very well-respected Capoeira Angola master, Brazilian, but now living in the States. And he's an expert player trained with the founding father of this particular style. But he's become older. And so some of his moves are, you know, how you move when you're older. And it's kind of funny to see a real young guy or woman doing moves with his signature style. You can say, oh, well, you know, they're mimicking Mestre João Grande, but an older Mestre João Grande. So you don't want to do that. But you still want to have the recognizable thumbprint of your style, I guess.
And I guess because I don't do capoeira, right? And before I knew much about, I mean, the first works that I read on capoeira were the Greg Downey, a few articles in his book, and I thought it was great. But there were certain alarm bells going off when it seemed to be popular. It seemed to be inordinately popular among academics of certain stripes, like maybe sociologists and ethnographers and anthropologists and people interested in dance. And it just seemed to have a like a hypertrophic kind of status in certain fields where things should be a bit cool and a bit ethnic and a bit like, oh yeah, well, this is a sort of ethnic-y underclass. And it just struck me as a bit alarm bells going, nit, nit, you know, like white Western academic into something a bit ethnic and post-colonial. I mean, do you think that's me looking for something that was or seeing something that wasn't there because I'm quite alert to that kind of thing? Or do you think that it became popular among academics and maybe artists and kind of liberal kind of people precisely because it's got a cool sounding history? I mean, a horrific history, really, but like sounds cool.
It's super cool, right? I mean, if you're part of the left wing liberal academia, it does check off all the boxes, right? It's all about resisting oppression, and it is cool and ethnic, and so I don't think you are wrong in that. I don't think I was when I first started studying it, I wasn't aware of any of that. I just kind of got sent in this direction. And it spoke to me kind of as the dancer, because it blended all of these things at the same time. You've got your acrobatics, you've got your dance, you've got your sparring, you've got your music. So I think one of the reasons it attracts so many people is because it has all of those different aspects. It wasn't until I started applying for grants and I got feedback. Somebody said, this is, I can't even remember what they said. It was a really funny turn of phrase. But they basically said it's too popular at this point. We're capoeirated out. I was like, oh, well, I didn't realize that I was in the cool thing, and now it's
Yeah,
overdone.
I wonder if and this is just speculation at this point. I wonder if there's something about capoeira and Brazilian jiu-jitsu which is shared in that they're both martial and they're both effective and they're both deeply violent practices if you want them to be. They're both life and death practices if you want. If some of those kicks, they're gonna kill you, man. And the, you know, like, but in their execution, in the training, in the way that they say you handle conflict, they're actually taking a lot of violence out of the world. And I wonder if that's, I mean, when I first got into, I mean, I'm a Brazilian jiu-jitsu like newbie, you know, like I'm a lifelong hitter and puncher, you know, and this, I wanted to learn how to grapple and wrestle and subdue rather than destroy,
right.
Rather than break, just subdue would be an interesting skill set. And it's like it sucks the violence out of a situation. I mean, do you think there might be something? It's not entirely unique, judo, aikido, etc.
But well, rather than answering that exactly, what I would definitely want to say is that there are some groups that do not do that. And I think that these are really understudied. So when you look at the scholarly literature on capoeira, it tends to focus on the ludic aspects. It talks about the latent violence. Janelle Joseph, I love her stuff. But she talks about capoeira as practiced in Canada, really having the latent violence. But if these individuals want to go to Brazil, they feel like they need to train and be more prepared because it's going to be more violent when they get there. That's all well and good, but I think what's understudied in the literature are some of these groups, and I'm thinking of one in particular that I won't mention by name, but they know who they are, who really focus on the utility of it. And I think the reason they do is their demographics. So this is a group that is heavily Afrocentric. And when I trained with the US master of this particular group, it was a 1-day event, and every single move he showed, he basically gave a context in which you may have to be violent. And what really stood out to me, he said, he's addressing the majority in the room saying, you guys are black men. You're not going to use this in X scenario because the police are going to, you know, come after you and you're going to be subjected to violence and potentially murdered by the police as a result of this. So use this move instead, which doesn't look violent, but it's going to get the job done, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that, yes, in most capoeira, as it is taught in the diaspora, the violence has been taken out, but some people preserve it on purpose because of its ethnic history.
Okay, yeah. And then I guess because there are different kind of magnetisms and different force fields and different issues in play around ethnicity and authenticity and mm-hmm. legitimacy and who is able to be called what and use which terms and so on. But I'm wondering about the status of community. Like, remember in California, and you've just given your keynote about how great capoeira is.
Yeah.
And I just kind of went, but isn't it just a cult? It's a cult. And I kind of blurted that out. And you said, well, yeah, it is. And that's really, what's really interesting. And after my first Brazilian jiu-jitsu lesson, a friend of mine who he taught me kung fu, he taught me tai chi, and then he left all of that and went off to become a jiu-jitsu black belt. And I told him, I'm going to a class. And I came out of the class and I texted him, I've been to a class. And he was like, welcome to the cult.
Right.
There's something uniquely intense about the relationships you form in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And you make friends in all martial arts, but I've never felt anything quite as powerful because you're breaking down these distances between people. I'm a bit worried about the future of such practices after this pandemic, if they don't get a definitive vaccine or whatever.
Right.
But is this, because there are real intense communal bonds in capoeira circles, right? I mean, do you think that's distinct, or do dancers have these things, or do...
No. I haven't seen it anywhere else the way I do in the capoeira community. And I wish I could put my finger on exactly what it is. I think it's a lot of things. And that's part of what I'm going to be exploring in the book that I'm working on right now. Just what is it about the form of capoeira, the structure of the capoeira community that leads to that? But I haven't seen it in many other groups. Now, I don't think it's every capoeira school that has this. So I went to one group and, you know, they have a contract. It's a relatively high-priced school. Some people love it. Some people hate it. It's kind of a come do your capoeira and then leave it all at the door. And then there are others where you don't really know where capoeira stops. Like, at what point do you go home? I took a 2-hour class with them. And then 2 hours later, we were still all sitting around on the floor and just jamming and having fun and hanging out. Is that still kept with a class, or is that just friends, or they really talk about themselves as a family? And people bring their kids and they're running around. So the lines between training and just general community are so blurred. And you see that in BJJ too?
You do. I mean, because I'm a kind of obsessive person, like when I get into something, I get into it, right? And so I was training in four different clubs, like from the word go, like when is there a class on, right?
Yeah.
And my body was, I've probably permanently injured myself straight away. But my knee is getting better now, thanks to this lockdown.
You don't have the ears yet, so you're okay.
No, and I already feel ambivalent about that. I mean, like all my life, you look at cauliflower ears of wrestlers and you go, oh, that's ridiculous. And then after you've been surrounded by them for a little while and what it signifies, you're like, you know, I don't think I would have surgery if I had a problem. I don't think I will. Anyway, what was I saying? Oh, yeah. So one of the BJJ classes is in an MMA club. Like, it's an MMA gym, boxing and MMA. They do Thai boxing as well. And that means that all the people in that club who do BJJ also do MMA.
Okay.
And the vibe was very different. I mean, I quite liked it, but yeah. It was closer to what I'm used to. Whereas the other clubs, there's more chill, there's more chat, much more like one-on-one. I mean, you know, we're not in Brazil. We're either in Cardiff or in Wiltshire or in Somerset, in these places that I travel.
Yeah.
But the MMA club was intense, and it was like, we're training now, and we're not stopping training. But in the other club, it's like sit around chatting and, oh, here's a technique, and have you thought about this? And so there's something... Like my former instructor, he said maybe that's the kind of Brazilian way. You're just hanging out. And
I don't know, because that's not the typical vibe in capoeira classes. It may not be as intense as the MMA, like we're gonna do this and this and this, but it is pretty steady, intensive training for those 2 hours, right? You're not taking water breaks. I remember the first time I took a capoeira class and I thought, oh, I'm just going to bring my water bottle and stop and get a sip of water. The mestre that was in charge took my berimbau apart and took the stick and just started like swiping it under my legs. And I had to do handstands back and forth over and over and over and over until he finally knocked me on my butt. And he was like, do not drink water during class. So there's that kind of intensity. So the Brazilian chill doesn't really transfer into every class setting.
Okay.
But it is interesting that you notice those differences.
Yeah, I do. And well, anyway, what I wanted to, I don't want to reflect too much on BJJ, although I think this connection is, I think there's an interesting cultural and possibly somatic and technical connections that are interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I have this vision in my head, right? Of, because you spend a lot in BJJ, you're on the floor. And now that we're in lockdown, everyone's doing solo drills, and there's a lot of spinning around on the floor, like on your front and on your back. And
yeah,
it wouldn't take much to go whoosh, it wouldn't take much to spin that helicopter up and become like capoeira. But that's a digression, definitely. I wanted to maybe end this conversation on, you mentioned your next project. I mean, how far along is that? And you're looking at the structure of community and the structure of practice. And
So good news. As of like 2 weeks ago, I have an advanced contract for this book with University of Illinois Press.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So hopefully it'll be out. I think I've got a year to write it, and then it'll go into the production process. But it's really looking at how involvement in capoeira overlaps with social activism. The title is going to be Graceful Resistance, or at least that's the working title right now, because we talk about capoeira being a form of resistance, but it's not in your face, aggressive. It tends to be subtle. It's disguised as dance. So it's a graceful form of resistance. So each chapter of the book is going to be looking at a different way of being an activist in capoeira. I want to look at those people who came to capoeira because of its history. So some people said, you know, I didn't want to do something bougie. I wanted to do something that felt a little bit gritty, that was still in touch with sort of this legacy of slavery. That's what appeals to me. Okay. And then there are other people who maybe had no interest in activism or were kind of neutral, started doing capoeira because it looked cool. And through the process, they started to realize things about society that they didn't like, and they became moved to do activism work. I'm thinking of one guy in particular who grew up in Detroit, or just outside of Detroit. And, you know, his social world was fairly privileged, didn't know many people of color, started training capoeira. He used to think that racial profiling was either exaggerated or a thing of the past, not something to worry about. Starts training capoeira and develops this respect and admiration for his teacher, for other people in the group. And when they start talking about racial profiling, he listens. And that, of course, leads him to take action. So that's the kind of stuff that I'm going to be looking at in the next book. The majority is that social activism, and then a little bit of it is, we talk about being this community that fights back against oppression, but what about within our community? What are some of the problems that we need to look at, like lingering sexism, homophobia, that kind of stuff?
Okay, and I mean, special request from me. Will you also be looking at apolitical, like studio based, like this is nice, and also will you be looking at the underside, the ugly side, the people who are less political but maybe more violent, more connected to, you know, a real gritty, like gritty, ugly kind of world? Or are you just going for the stuff that you like?
Well, I foreground the stuff I like. No, I make it very clear that this is not everybody. This is a subset of the capoeira community that is politically engaged. I think it's an important subset. I think it's one of the things that makes the at least U.S. capoeira community unique. That's what I can speak to. But I do acknowledge that there are other groups that are just not interested in capoeira as a form of activism. Now, some people will look at that and say, even if you don't mean for it to be political, the very fact that you're keeping alive an art that was perpetuated by enslaved Africans is a political act. So I'll mention that, but I'm going to engage with that a little bit. As far as the other one, the capoeiristas that are engaged in the real nitty gritty violent stuff. If I had access to it, yes. I feel like I don't have a lot of access to people that are you know,
yeah,
legitimately doing bad stuff with capoeira. My vision of the world has been kind of this polished, privileged corner, I guess.
Okay, well, that sounds great. I mean, I think maybe we should leave it on that then, because that's the cliffhanger. That's the looking forward to the next thing. So I guess I'll say thank you very much. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you. This has been really fun.